to Practicing Connection in a Complex World, a podcast exploring the personal stories and collective practices that empower us to work together to help each other, our families, and our communities improve our resilience and readiness in a rapidly changing world.
Hi, I'm Bob Birch. My co-host, Jessica Beckendorf, will join us in just a few minutes, as well as our collaborators for this episode, Danielle Swallow and Chris Patrone from Delaware Sea Grant. Danielle and Chris have been doing some great work reaching out to communities to help them prepare for and build resilience to the many hazards and disasters we all face. What you're about to hear is an exploration of the intersections between Danielle and Chris's work on disaster preparedness and resilience, and the work Jessica and I do on practicing connection, starting with Danielle and I exploring the meaning of community resilience. So this idea of community resilience is interesting to me, really the idea that not just that we can be resilient as individuals, but that together we have some capacity for being resilient as a community or in community with each other. And it seems to have a lot of connections to, you know, not just our individual community or resilience as people in the community, but also, you know, our resilience as the community itself, socially and politically, and even ecologically. So I'm really interested in this, Danielle, in the context of your work, of how you think of community resilience, you know, when we talk about disaster response and disaster preparedness.
I think of community resilience as being very anticipatory and really thinking about not just the present day conditions, but sort of what kind of conditions might the community experience in the future. And that could mean changing weather patterns or climate change. It could be even like demographic changes in the community. And when we can understand how the future might look, we can better prepare ourselves. And particularly if we're thinking about climate change and weather as bringing certain disruptive events or changes that might not be easily absorbed by everyone in the community, we can take steps now to better adapt and mitigate so we can weather those changes and bounce back more quickly. You know, in a lot of ways, resiliency is about bouncing back.
That sense of adaptation, whatever you want to call it, maybe flexibility or just being comfortable or prepared for change, is that, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. Like, what do you think the capacities are of a community? Like, how would we describe a community that had that capacity or that was resilient?
It really varies, but you know, we all practice adaptations on a daily basis. You know, we look at the weather report, or we look at the sky and we see what kind of weather we might be having and we bring an umbrella, for example, or wear a coat, right? But then there's sort of other types of situations that we have to prepare for. Maybe there's larger types of adaptations that are needed. New roads and infrastructure as the community grows. Maybe it's modernizing, you know, our stormwater infrastructure because we're anticipating more rainfall in the future. There's really just a scale of adaptations that are important to a community. And understanding how changes impact a community as a whole is important, but it's also important to understand how it impacts individuals and segments of the population. Some groups in the population may be more sensitive to certain impacts than others. And so adaptation needs to be thought of in a very comprehensive way.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up individuals. You know, I keep thinking a little bit about Dr. Michael Unger's definition of individual resilience, about this capacity to be able to navigate to and negotiate for resources on an individual level. And I think there's some work I want to say it's McConnell and colleagues who talk about what community resilience really is a community's capacity for making sure that individuals can navigate to and negotiate for the resources that they need to be individually resilient. Like if everybody can do that, right? Everybody can get this, the resources that they need, then we have a resilient community. So I'm, like I said, I'm glad you brought up the people in the equation, because it's easy to think about, well, maybe it's not easy, but often we think about sort of the built capital of a community, and maybe don't pay attention as much to how we would be resilient in terms of the human or social capital.
Yeah, I mean, just think about what we're living through right now with COVID-19. And in terms of individuals, all of us have been in the situation of having to find PPE, you know, the protective equipment, like masks. We've all had to be kind of industrious and scrappy and trying to go and find masks, especially in the early days. Or think of Clorox wipes or, you know, your other cleaning supplies. There are issues like broadband, you know, that affects certain groups of individuals more than others. Maybe they have more access or less access. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of needs out there that affect different individuals in different ways.
Yeah. So what do you think, so when you're working with communities on building resilience, especially to, you know, to climate change or severe weather events, where do you ask people to start? Is it just by understanding the concept or planning or all of the above?
Definitely understanding kind of the concept of resilience helps. It's sort of like your goal is to get there. But I also believe it also starts with knowing what your risks are. And that can include really putting risks in the context of future conditions. You know, you have risks today in terms of weather and climate, but the risks 10, 20, 30 years from now are going to be different, you know, because of the onset of additional climate changes. And so I start with knowing what your risks are, knowing what hazards you are potentially going to be exposed to and how sensitive you might be to those hazards, because those hazards could impact you differently than a neighbor or someone else in town. And then when you understand your exposure and your sensitivity and overall vulnerability, you can take steps to help mitigate those risks. And by mitigating risk or adapting to them, you're ultimately setting yourself up to be able to manage those changes, you know, in a better sense than maybe someone who hasn't done that planning.
So I think some of us might think that this is, when we think about community resilience, we, you know, might think of, well, there's probably a committee for that, right? Or our political leaders should be worried about that. But it seems like, and you know, and I think because of the nature of the Practicing Connection in a Complex World podcast, that we also want to think about it in different ways and how relationship figures into that. So can you talk a little bit about at an individual or an organizational level, you know, inside of a community, how do people contribute to community resilience, or how can they think about community resilience in that, in their own context?
From an organizational level, I think it really helps to understand where you can contribute to the conversation and the dialogue and the preparation. And I think it also helps to really look inward at the organization and first make sure that the relationships and networks within your organization are strong. And that once, you know, if you're strong, then you can go out and help others in the community. Because at the end of the day, resilience is about sort of networks of people working together to help prepare and adapt for future conditions. I think that's it. It's the strength of the networks that will get us through.
So if community resilience relies heavily on all of our networks, I think that it would be a good idea for us to share a little bit about not only how this collaboration came about, because it came about because of a network. We didn't choose this topic and then go and seek out speakers initially. It happened because we were looking for a completely different type of collaboration, and Chris contacted us. So I think that that was really cool. Chris contacted us, and from our conversation with Chris, we talked about a collaboration around this topic. Chris, would you mind kind of chiming in on this? You know, why is community resilience important to you? And talk a little bit about, you know, I guess how we came together in this collaboration and why it interested you.
Yeah. So a few years ago, our sort of parent agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, really took a hard look and encouraged us as Sea Grant programs to look at resilience and start to incorporate it. We were doing a lot of that work anyway, but they really wanted us to focus on resilience and what that meant to all our different stakeholders in terms of family resilience, community resilience, economic resilience, ecological resilience. And so, you know, it's something that's been our minds as a Sea Grant staff for many years. And so when you all were talking about how to do resilience from a military family standpoint, I think a lot of the things that we deal with in resilience here on the coast play into inland, no matter where you are in the country. Some of the same lessons that can be learned here on the coast can be applied just about anywhere. And so when Jessica put out a call on Twitter for interest in podcasts, I sort of raised my hand and we made the connection and developed this idea of bringing in Sea Grant, an organization, at least in terms of Delaware Sea Grant, an organization that hasn't had a lot of interaction with military families, to talk a little bit about our view of resilience here in Delaware.
Yeah, Chris, it's there's a couple of things that really kind of sparked for me as we're talking about this. One is there's some serendipity to how we got started. And part of that was planned serendipity because Jessica and I had to say that we were interested in collaborating with somebody. We had to actually put out the call, right, and say, hey, we're working on this, and sort of make ourselves visible to everyone that gave us the opportunity to kind of pop into there. So that's really interesting to me. And the other thing that's kind of interesting, and Jess or Chris, either one of you, you know, part of the contact was built on familiarity between the two of you guys. You guys had at least the start of a connection before we got together to talk about this collaboration.
Yeah, thanks to the Extension Foundation training that we both had in Dayton, Ohio in 2017. That's where Jessica and I met. We hit it off. We had similar interests, similar personalities, and subsequently followed each other on Twitter, and years later, here we are.
Yeah, really, it was a simple tweet that kind of started this collaboration. But what I think I'm excited about with this, as it relates to collaboration in general, is that we really tried to co-create this with the two of you. So like I said, we didn't start with the topic, but we started with the people and the relationship, and it kind of went from then. We got to meet Danielle, who knows a lot about resilience. So maybe if I could just ask you guys, and Danielle, please do chime in if you have something to say about what kind of drew you to this topic as well, or to this collaboration. And
well, you know, Jessica, I work on resiliency and working with communities to help build that resiliency as part of my day job. But I have to say that I'm from a military family myself. My husband is a retired officer. He started out his career with the Navy and then transferred to the NOAA Commissioned Officer Corps. A lot of people don't realize that the nation has 7 uniformed services, and the NOAA Corps is probably like the Public Health Service in that they're not an armed service. but they're a commissioned uniform service, and he has the same rank and structure as the Navy. That's what they call it. And so my husband spent his career being deployed on ships to different parts of the world to support NOAA's science gathering activities, like coral reefs, research. He actually spent the majority of his career doing nautical charting for sea navigation. So anyway, I have a lot of affinity for military things.
That's cool. You know, I think that actually might be what got me interested in the idea of community resilience. I didn't think of it in those terms until I was an adult and I started to understand resilience. But Danielle, I also I was a military kid. My dad was in the Navy, career Navy. He retired quite some time ago now. And I've always been super interested in place in particular, and in connecting with people, right? Because I had to do it every couple of years. I had to learn how to connect real fast. I have a bigger problem with staying connected than I do with connecting with people right away. But I think that's probably what helped get me interested in it is that background. And I'm really interested in the idea of staying connected because I struggle with that. I think in part because I got so good at meeting new people that and doing it every couple of years.
Yeah, you know, I think being in a military family, especially when family members are deployed and you're moving around the country or world, you really have to find new networks and find local family, so to speak. I know that when my husband was deployed, he was deployed 2 years at a time. He was out to sea 250 days a year. At one point, he was out in Hawaii, and I stayed back in Maryland. And that can be kind of lonely. And so I really relied a lot on my NOAA Corps family. And that really helped get me through, kind of that separation. So networks are really important. And I think, us military families can really appreciate that.
Jessica, I don't think it's strange that you have this tough time staying connected. I think we all do. I think because we are constantly meeting new people and making new relationships, we get busy, we have other things going on. And so a lot of those ties weaken a bit over time, and we just don't make the connections that we should or we want to do just because we are so busy. And so I think that in terms of resilience, as long as those connections get set up and are established and sort of foundational at the start, when there is a need for a relationship, they're still there. They haven't gone away. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm not alone in that. and also, Chris, I'm going to take that as your way of saying you'll still be here for me when I need it.
Whenever you need a podcast buddy, I will be here.
Nice. Thank you.
The key to resilience is, are you prepared? And I think the more we can do now to prepare for the next big emergency, it's all about muscle memory. And we do this, we start this as a kid in elementary school, fire drill, right? You do the fire drill once a month or whatever it is, so if there's a fire, I am supposed to get in that line and I follow the teacher out this way and we go to this door and we meet up here and we check in and everything's good. It's the same thing in sports. We practice and practice and practice that in a game. We have that muscle memory. We know exactly what we are supposed to do in that game to be successful. And I think that happens. We don't do it as much as probably we should. And I think a major part of this resilience and resiliency and emergency preparedness is understanding our role. What is our role in terms of emergency preparedness or resilience in our family, in our neighborhood, in our office or our work environment, understanding our individual roles in resilience.
I'm involved right now with a really cool example of a local resiliency type of organization called the CAPE Community for Coordination for COVID, CCC for COVID. And their website is cccforcovid.org. And this is a group that was started by a local business owner in March, right as, you know, the shutdowns were happening with COVID-19. And she felt a strong need to try to help in the community, but she wasn't really sure where the needs were. And so she just started reaching out to her neighbors and contacts, and they formed a group. And they started meeting and trading information about what they knew and where the needs were. And over time, it grew into a coalition of 70 different organizations and individuals. And they include groups like the local school district and mayors and business owners and local nonprofits and the farmers market and just a wide range of individuals and groups. And by banding together, they were able to get kind of a good feel for where local response activities were maybe lagging or that the needs were just outpacing the response. And so one of the areas, they plugged in a lot of different ways. Like they plugged in as far as like helping to procure masks at the early stages of response and helping to get computers into the hands of children, you know, that were going to online schooling. But one of the other needs that they got really involved in had to do with food insecurity and food nutrition. And the school district was mentioning that they were getting a lot of calls from people in the school district that had emergency needs for food. And there were different distribution points around the county, but not everyone knew where those distribution points were and what the schedule was for those. So CCC for COVID organized a flyer that pinpointed the different locations and when the distributions would occur and what kinds of items were included. And then they went a step further and they translated that into Spanish and Creole for some of our other community members where English isn't their first language. And printed hundreds of copies, and they started distributing them at some of these distribution points and giving them to the school district. And the school district credits it with significantly reducing the number of emergency calls that they were getting. In addition, they took that same information and they put it into an interactive GIS-based map so that it could be used by local and state planning organizations to help coordinate response. And it's even been adopted by the Delaware Department of Agriculture now. They're expanding it to the rest of the state. But one of the other things that really happened is, you know, just as this network grew and on these weekly calls, we would trade information about like, hey, you know, my organization is seeing an uptick in people that are homeless. And my organization is seeing an uptick in people, you know, that need meals. We discovered that there was a local construction, like a housing construction group that was doing some of their own food distribution. But there was in our membership also a foundation that had food and resources to provide food. So we ended up pairing the two together. We said, hey, construction business, you have a warehouse, you have trucks, you've got volunteers for your staff. And this foundation has money and it has a food distribution supply chain. Let's merge you together. And it ended up being this beautiful, you know, relationship that really blossomed. And so over time, they ended up giving out hundreds of thousands of meal kits to the community. And so I think, you know, those examples just kind of illustrate the strength of networks. And this is, you know, what Chris and Jessica were talking about, and what we've kind of raised before. It's just when groups band together, you know, they become a force multiplier, and they can better understand needs, and they can better try to serve those needs. And so I've been really fortunate to get involved with this group, and I've particularly plugged in as far as helping this group coordinate services to senior citizens who are really experiencing a lot of social isolation, and, you know, access to information. They're not always comfortable getting their information online. And so how do we get information in their hands? And I've also been helping them with raising supplies that are non-food items, but, you know, your hygiene products, cleaning supplies, to include that in some of the food distribution efforts. And then also working to really formalize this group, because we think we're onto something. We think that even though this started in a very ad hoc way, it demonstrates the capabilities and also the need that was out there. And we realized that some of the needs that we're filling don't necessarily go away once COVID-19 kind of is in our rearview mirror. There's ongoing needs of homelessness and food insecurity, you know, access to broadband. And we think this coalition can help elevate some of these needs and kind of sound the alarm bell and help to coordinate services.
Hello, I'm Sarah Kreimans from the Military Families Learning Network Family Transitions team. I'd like to tell you about the Military Family Readiness Academy, a free professional development opportunity designed for military family service providers working in any field with any organization. The 2020 Academy series will focus on the unique needs of service members and their families and the added stressors and challenges when disasters and emergencies strike. Join us as we explore this complex issue in two parts, offered in fall 2020 and winter 2021. The 2020 Academy will provide an overview of disaster and emergency readiness information, tools, and resources for military family service providers working in any field as they help military families navigate the unique context of military life. Check out the Military Family Readiness Academy at https://militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/MFRA.
You know, this has been such a great experience and rewarding collaboration on this episode, working with you, Danielle, and with you, Chris. And we're so glad to have learned from you. But I want to get to some of the things like we can actually do, like how do we put this in action? We've learned a lot. And the podcast is called Practicing Connection. So what practices can we kind of put into play here to build up to the idea of community resilience? Danielle, like, what are the things that personally we should be doing, you know, to start to build that resilience and readiness practice? How do we get started individually and maybe in our at that individual and family level of being prepared for disasters?
Yeah, Bob, I think it starts with first really trying to understand what your risks are in your particular household or your area. Maybe it's knowing that you're in a community or state that has a high degree of risk of tornadoes, or you experience droughts from time to time. Or maybe it's understanding that you are in a household where there's members of the household that have, epilepsy or, you know, are hard of hearing. And so, you have certain individual risks to manage. And then I think it's kind of thinking about some emergency preparedness steps that you can take right off the bat to kind of be in a better position. One of the things I like to advocate for is signing up for emergency notification systems. They do vary, you know, from state to state and locality to locality, but having signing up for these, especially making sure your cell phones are registered, that'll enable emergency responders in the state to send messages your way. For example, if a flash flood, you know, is imminent in the area. There's a national system called Smart 911, and you can go to smart911.com. Not every community has it yet, although the website says 45 million people participate in it nationwide. We really encourage you to look into it. It basically populates the 911 database with more information about your household. So if you have a family member that has a severe allergy, you can note that in the database. If you have somebody I mentioned before that might be hard of hearing, well, that's good for emergency responders to know, because you know, knocking on the door isn't necessarily going to be useful, right, if they're coming to the house. So this information comes up on their screen as they're en route to a house to respond to a fire or an emergency. And it gives them that much more information to work with. So really encourage that. And beyond that, you know, it's important to have an emergency supply kit and to always have extra copies of your prescriptions or, you know, refills with you. And to also have a communications plan with you and your family members. Sometimes we end up having to evacuate on short notice, or our power goes out, you know, we get separated. And having a communications plan ahead of time gives assurance to different family members that they sort of know how what you're going to do in those situations. It lets them know, like, here's the rallying point, you know, that we're going to go to if we all have to evacuate from our jobs or schools separately. You can designate an out-of-town family member or friend to be a central point of contact, so that if power goes out and then comes back on in a spotty way, and folks are evacuating, they're all sending, you know, messages maybe through social media, or eventually when they get phone back to that same individual who can kind of triage that and keep track of all the family members. And that really just ensures that the family is not, you know, dealing with added stress during an already stressful time.
Yeah, I think a key, you know, Danielle mentioned understanding your risk. And I think a key to resilience, preparedness and resilience is not only understanding your role, but who are the players? Who do I need to know to make this situation better? And that applies to the family level, the community level, and then also your work level. You know, I think about, you know, if there's an oil spill here in Delaware Bay, my family isn't necessarily impacted. Right. We don't have to have a plan for that. But with my job, with Delaware Sea Grant, we need to be able to respond in some way if an oil spill happens. That is a major concern for the environment and for tourism and to all the industries that we work in. And so having a plan in place for all these different kinds of situations can only make us stronger and more resilient.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Practicing Connection in a Complex World. Jessica and I would also like to thank Kaylin Goebel and Sarah Kreumans for sharing their voices on today's episode, Hannah Hyde and Terry Meisenbaugh for helping us with promotion, and Nathan Grimm for composing and performing all the music you hear on the podcast. Finally, thanks to Danielle Swallow and Chris Patrone from Sea Grant Delaware for their generous contributions to this collaboration. You can find out more about Sea Grant Delaware and find more ways to start building your individual, family, and community resilience by visiting our show page at militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/series/practicingconnection. I hope you'll join us for our next episode, and in the meantime, keep practicing.